This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource, a reference for broadcast engineers, on the web at thebdr.net, and by Bill Meeks at Meeks Mixed Media, maximizing brands large and small in the new media space, on the web at meeksmixedmedia.com.
And now, our feature presentation, Twirt.
Now the doctor can diagnose, see what's happening real time. And then, if they want, they can conference the doctor with video.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Doc?
Yeah, all your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And this week, I'm in Riga, Latvia. Joining me, Chris Tarr from Milwaukee and Chris Tobin from New York City.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi there, I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Glad to be with you, and this time coming to you from a different country. Now, I've done that a couple of times. This time, I've got a pretty good internet connection. Coming to you live from Riga, Latvia. Formerly part of the Soviet Union and now independent. And Riga is just a beautiful city in the summertime. It's just gorgeous days here. The sun went down this evening at about 11 p.m. and it'll be back up about 4:30 in the morning. So long days during the summer in Latvia. Of course, you know, you pay for that in the winter when, you know, your daylight's 4 hours long during the winter days. But enough about where I am. Doesn't matter where that is. Let's go talk to Chris Tobin, our gentleman about town from Manhattan. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Kirk. I hear you're it's 3 o'clock in the morning, your local time.
Long it day. Is. Yeah, actually. I've been here for a, we have a seminar of all of the dealers of my employer, Telos, Omnia, and Axia. And they're all here in Riga for learning and talking to each other and figuring out our new technology and being exposed to it. So we're here for about 3 days in Riga. And this was just a convenient place for us all to get together and show off some gear. So we're at a gorgeous hotel, the Tall Link Hotel, which is also the name of a cruise line that floats between Helsinki, St. Petersburg, over to Sweden and also Tallinn, Estonia, and then here in Riga. So anyway, nice hotel, very modern city, really clean, terrific food, and it's just been a good time. So Chris Tobin, you're working some night times, aren't you? Going to the Empire State Building tonight?
Tonight's a quick overnight, doing some work at our transmitter facilities for our FM stations at the Empire State Building. So I get to see Manhattan from about 1,200 feet above sea level. And until about 1 a.m., it's bright lights everywhere. And then around 1:30, 2 a.m., it starts to get dark. And that's about it. But it's going to be a fun time.
Cool. All right. Well, you can tell us more about that a little later in the show. And Chris Tarr is with us from Milwaukee. Hello, Chris Tarr.
Hello there. The only thing going on at 3 in the morning here is a little cow tipping.
That's great. I wonder if they do that in Riga, Latvia. Hey, comrade, you want to go cow tipping?
we cow tip now. You have fun. Yes.
All right. Well, it's a free-for-all show on this week of This Week in Radio Tech. We talk about on the show things that have to do with radio technology. If you're a new listener, hey, welcome in. We're glad to have you. And radio technology encompasses really quite a lot. Everything from microphone technology like this one, a dynamic mic, the quality of mic preamps, designs of those, analog and digital systems, IP systems like IP audio systems like the one right behind me here. And then also we get into transmission of audio from one place to another, namely to a transmitter site. And we also talk about RF technology and how to get that signal out to the masses, whether it's AM or FM or some kind of digital radio. So there's a lot in between, and engineers at radio stations and TV stations are usually tasked with doing a lot of different things. If it has to do with technology, they're usually called upon to do something about it if it breaks or if some advice is needed on implementing it. So it's a really, really wide-ranging subject. So we have a number of things to talk about, and we're taking a few ideas from the chat room as well. So let's get right into it. Understand, Chris Tobin, you attended a seminar that had to do with an interesting technology that you know, radio stations will be able to apply. It's a bit more of a consumer technology, I suppose, though. Tell us about what you witnessed today.
Oh, okay. Actually, it's the, I guess, what's going to be called 4G in the cellular world. Actually, I think that the proper term is 3.9G for some reason. I think that's the trademarked name.
Okay.
Go figure. But in any case, yes, it was a Verizon seminar on their deployment of 4G, otherwise known as LTE, long-term evolution, which is about, I think, 89% of the world's carriers are looking to deploy that. It's competing technology to WiMAX, which is another type of 4G service. And today's session was to talk about how the system functions, how to use it or apply it, and where it's going to go in the next couple of years. If I took the session correctly on the information, it's an IP platform, okay, from start to finish, from the point you make the phone call or if using the data card. So it's a data connection from two, from the beginning to end is all IP. They have designed the ability to jump between IP networks. So if you're a Verizon customer of the fiber service called Fios and you have a 4G LTE enabled laptop or enabled handheld device, you could actually traverse the networks to transfer a call, say, from your cell phone handheld to your home phone if you're using IP phone service from Verizon Fios. That's just one example. It's very rudimentary. I looked at the return time, you know, the time it takes for a packet to leave and come back, and you know, round trip time or a ping test, and they can guarantee at least 50 milliseconds round trip. So if you're familiar with ISDN protocols, and as we know, you know, G.722, the universally accepted low quality but most robust, reliable connection that you could ever get, I believe the latency on that connection is 55 to 80 milliseconds, somewhere in there. So essentially, LTE offers the bandwidth of, say, your home DSL or home cable modem, depending on where you are. So the bandwidth will vary, say, from 5 to 15 megabits download to, I think, 2.5 to 5 megabits upload. Granted, that's not probably as high as a cable modem, but it's still higher than what you get right now on your 3G phone. And you have a latency of less than 50 milliseconds. So if you want to do real-time applications, as Verizon calls them, as we would call the same thing, 50 milliseconds, we can have a broadcast, live broadcast from a location and do interaction. And you know how you have a satellite, if you do satellite linking, it's about a second and a half or 2 seconds, depending on which satellite you're on. If you do
like you see when news organizations go do a live report from Iraq or some place where news is breaking, they don't have more permanent facilities in there. They're using a satellite phone that has a lot
of delay.
Exactly. Yeah.
So the session talked about how the new platform, that someone will call the new platform, is IP-based, which means they showed you e-healthcare solutions where a doctor is contacted in an emergency room at a hospital by a paramedic in an ambulance talking or using a tablet-type device that's LTE-enabled and transferring images taken from the medical machine, the whatever, say it will just say heart machine checking rhythms and creating a graph which you'd see on a piece of paper. Now they can transfer electronically to the doctor on a tablet, sort of like you see in the movies like ER and Grey's Anatomy and all those other wonderful shows. Now the doctor can diagnose, see what's happening real time, and then if they want, they can conference the doctor with video to the paramedic in a moving vehicle, and they can do remote, I guess they call it remote sensing healthcare. Medicine.
Yeah, sure. So we really have a hard time doing this now, even with 3G services, right? Because the latency is so high. Sometimes you end up. Sometimes when we have some gear at our company, Telos, that we connect using a 3G modem from one end to another. The other end is typically wired to the internet, and the remote end is on a 3G modem. And sometimes we see some pretty high delay, which makes carrying on a two-way conversation rather difficult. Now, there's a little bit of delay in the process of coding and decoding, but we're seeing network delays. I shouldn't pick on anybody, but I've been using a Sprint card for quite a while, and we've seen some pretty significant delays there. We've also seen trace routes that take where the packets go all over the country six times before they arrive at their destination when the destination, you know, may be just the next state away. So I don't
really
understand.
Well, you're just holding it wrong. That's the problem.
What's that?
You're holding it wrong. That's the problem. You need to hold it in the center of the device, not at the bottom. It'll work fine then.
Okay. Yeah, you're referencing the new iPhone 4, right?
Yes, I am.
But I thought you may have been talking about my basketball coach. You're holding it wrong. All right. So anyway, Chris, Tobin, back to you. And there's some more intelligence in laying out the 4G networks, right? And we should have much lower end-to-end delay.
Yeah. I think basically anyone who's researched the current 3G systems, which is based on the Qualcomm CDMA technology, the radio interface, which is the cellular phone, the modem, the USB modem, whatever you use, according to the engineers, according to the white papers I've read over the last couple of years, is basically a best effort connection for the wireless. Best effort. There is no quality of service ratings or scalability. It's pretty much one way. It was based on voice with some data as an overhead. Routing was based on some IP approaches, but a lot of the old-fashioned LATA, L-A-T-A, tariff, telco border lines between states and regions. So the LTE, WiMAX, and a few other technologies that are coming out over the next 12 months looked at the downside of the current systems and said, we need to improve. So it's IP-based. I'll use the analogy, take your office LAN or your home LAN wired, right? Router wires out to the computers in your house. Replace the wiring with the wireless of LTE. Keep all the endpoints the same. This is what the technology brings to you. So everything you can do now with a LAN, from VLANs to quality of service to any queue tagging, anything you want to do, LTE can support, but does it wirelessly. Think of the implications.
Well, that's what I want to focus on at least this part of the show, is let's bring this back around to broadcast. And sure, this 4G is important to consumers because you can do, you know, even more. Wow, whiz bang, you know, two-way video chat with your friends, and the data is going to get there, and it's going to be a lot more reliable than what we've been seeing. But why are you, as a broadcast engineer in New York City, excited about this? What's it going to enable you to do?
Well, I'll tell you, what it does for me on many levels. Well, first, radio stations that I work with, we have three AMs, three FMs. Of the AMs, we have two all news, one sports. So that's talk programming. The three FMs are music. On many occasions, we'll go with the music stations, get a request to do a live broadcast from some venue. And in order for us to do that properly, so that on the air, the radio experience is what we'd like, we got to get ISDN or maybe a DSL line and hope that it can be installed properly and it works. Second, we now have a new world. The new world order is multimedia. And our radio stations do a lot of web video. I'll call it web video for lack of a better term because it's used for other websites of the radio stations and for other projects. And now you're talking multimedia on platforms that don't support it, ISDN and limited DSL because it's just tough to get in some places at the moment for some odd reason. But now what do you do at a remote? The LTE approach allows you the same quality as that wired DSL or cable modem you may have access to, or a microwave link if you have the luxury of a truck that you have available at your disposal. Now you have it in a device you can carry, test in advance day of, and know where you stand. And LTE provides quality of service. Now, Verizon hasn't deployed a business model pricing structure yet, but they're not ruling out the fact that they'll give you tiered service on quality of service if you're willing to pay for it. So if you can do that, quality of service, get the bandwidth you need, 50 milliseconds or less. So I'll just say 50 milliseconds to be realistic. They're touting at times during this seminar, 30 milliseconds has been tested in a moving vehicle. That's really being, I think, overzealous. I'm going to go with 50 milliseconds on the safe side. Even and 50 now, milliseconds.
I wonder, what are the endpoints that they're measuring? In other words, right now, here I am talking to you from Latvia. But according to the Skype statistics, I've got a 224 millisecond round trip. So 110 milliseconds from one end to the other, from here to Petaluma, California at the Twit studio. So that's a wired connection from here, across the pond and then across the U.S. So I guess they're talking 50 milliseconds at least for the wireless part of the link, but they're not quoting that for the rest of the network to wherever you're going.
No. It's just for the wireless link. Let me clarify that. I was getting to that because that becomes a very scary thing if you could say 50 milliseconds end-to-end through the wireless to the far end. It's through the wireless link, which is, in the tradition of telephone terminology, the last mile. I call it the last mile, is the wireless portion. With Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint, I know I've done this with Sprint and Verizon, you can arrange to have a virtual private connection, a VPC, from their point of presence back to your facility to limit the number of hops you may want from their radio interface back to you. So you can, if you get 50 milliseconds on the wireless side, say 50 to 100 milliseconds latency, and you do a direct home run, if you will, from their pop back to your radio station, you've got yourself a really robust link, and you pretty much control everything because they can give you quality of service on that link leaving the point of presence.
I've got a couple of questions about LTE as opposed to WiMAX, but let's bring Chris Tarr in here. And Chris, in your market, what would this kind of technology, we've been hearing about it for a while, I've been hearing about WiMAX for, my goodness, 5 years, haven't we? And then I started hearing about LTE about a year ago. But have you seen any visibility on these services in your area? And if so, got some plans or visions of the equipment and the capabilities that it's going to give you as a broadcaster?
Well, we don't have those things yet. They're coming. I know that Sprint's building out their 4G here. It should be available fairly soon. But I'm just imagining all of the things that you can do with that. For now, we still use the old Comrex GSM codec that allows us to wirelessly do remotes from different locations. Of course, that bit rate isn't all that good. It's over GSM, which is a relatively slow connection. But just thinking about, for example, this weekend, we're going to be doing synchronized fireworks from a site in Madison. And that's always been a challenge because we have to use ISDN lines. And they're not, they're fairly reliable, but they're hard to get and they're hard to maintain. And the audio quality isn't perfect and the synchronization isn't perfect and, all these different things. And it's just such a hassle to set up. I'm just imagining how great it would be to have something like that. Boom, you're ready to go. So I really do think that IP is going to be the future of remote broadcast for radio. And I also think that, technologies like this are going to be a great enabler for things that we used to use, lots of MARTI gear for, and even some things that we couldn't use MARTI gear for. I think that it just opens up a world of possibilities.
Let's clue the listener in about what MARTI gear is. We use MARTI as a as if it were the common name for what we used to do with this gear. Tell us about MARTI gear.
MARTI is basically a remote pickup unit. It's a brand name for what's called an RPU, or remote pickup unit. And what that is that's generally either 150 megahertz, 440, or 450 megahertz radio link that radio stations use from remote locations. And generally, you'd have like a truck with a big antenna on it, and this is almost built-in radio station with a receiver at the studio side. And you'd basically use that to get your audio from one location back to the studio. It's basically just a portable little radio station. The inherent problems with those is obviously it's analog, so there's interference if somebody is messing around near your channel, or you've got atmospheric things, or you point the antenna in the wrong direction. There are those issues. And then, of course, there's also the human issue, like people leaving the mast up on the truck and driving under low bridges and things like that. So, they're kind of there's a lot of work to maintain those, to keep them aligned, and they don't sound the greatest to begin with. So, a lot of stations have actually been doing away with the RPU units and going with the POTS codecs. And you see a lot more of that now. But again, you're tethered to a phone line and you have to have one of those available. So as we look at these, this LTE and 4G, that eliminates all of those possibilities. You just need to go wherever you can get a signal. You can set up and do a live broadcast. I think it's great.
I wonder what the rollout of LTE is going to look like. Right now, if you take your I'm not sure about Verizon, but if you take your Sprint modem and drive around in rural areas, of course your speed that you're getting from that drops precipitously, down to dial-up kind of speeds. I was doing some tests around the Nashville area about a month ago, and right in Nashville, and maybe 20 miles in the direction I was going south towards Huntsville, I was still getting a megabit download and almost a megabit upload over the Sprint modem, but it's not deployed everywhere, and so you get into outer areas and you're down to 2G kind of speeds there. Chris, Tobin, did they give you an idea of a rollout schedule?
Yes, the rollout schedule begins fourth quarter 2010, 39 markets. I believe New York is definitely the first, and probably Chicago, L.A. They'll be doing more. You'll be seeing more about it in the next couple of weeks. They hope to have everything deployed and fully operational by 2013. But by the end of fourth quarter, they hope to have 100 million points of presence available on the network.
Yeah, I did. So they talk much about with the frequency allocations for getting this done.
700 megahertz. It's the 700 megahertz block C, I believe it was. Verizon.
Oh, that's fabulous because you're going to get some good building penetration with that then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's beachfront property that was given up by the broadcasters. The test they did, we had a cell site in the session in the ballroom. They had a small rack, which was an actual LTE cell. And they demonstrated the RF principles and everything about it. And I'm telling you, if what they showed is true to form, and I hope to go to the Murray Hill Labs, the Bell Labs in August to see the whole setup and all the various things they're doing with the LTE technology. If it's true what they say can be done, I believe it's a game changer for broadcasters who are smart to jump on the IP bandwagon, if you will, and make money with it. Because I can see from my FM stations, we could be out there doing a lot of stuff, making some good cash, because we can be on site much faster than ISDN can be deployed or POTS lines for POTS codecs can be deployed.
Oh, sure.
And then for spot news for our other stations, it's a slam dunk. But the music stations suffer the most because we had to pre-plan. And it just costs time and energy that just isn't worth it at times.
So was there any mention of LTE versus WiMAX? And why haven't we seen much in terms of WiMAX? And how is LTE better, if it is, than WiMAX?
I at the session, there was very little discussion of WiMAX. I believe that's because WiMAX originally was designed for microwave point-to-point access or portals, and it's evolved into a mobile environment. The downside is that people claim is it was originally meant to be stationary point-to-point. Now it's made mobile, so it's sort of a hybrid. I believe both can succeed. The technologies are ideal for both for both users. I think the reason they're trying to stay away from WiMAX or talking about it is because it's robust. It does work. I think they're just looking to go with what they can develop, migrate very easily from their current CDMA Qualcomm platform to LTE. I believe if you're going to go from CDMA to the WiMAX, is a lot of the radios change it. It might be a little more costly than it's worth. So if you're starting out new, you have a choice of LTE or WiMAX. The question did come up, okay, LTE, 89% of the carriers in the world allegedly will be deploying this technology. Then the question that follows, if I have a Verizon LTE phone with a SIM card, that's the other thing. The LTE technology uses a SIM card, so it now becomes the SIM chip is your information, not the hardware. So you're no longer authenticating with the hardware. Gotcha. Can I take my Verizon and go, say, to where you are right now in Riga and register my phone onto that LTE network if and when it should exist? Nobody could answer the question. So my guess is, mm-hmm. Yes, LTE is a great technology and allows for so much interoperability. I don't know if the carriers themselves are willing to allow each other into their camps. Mm. So the time will tell. But for now, in the United States, LTE across the board is covered throughout the entire country, and deployment will begin in fourth quarter.
And I'm Chris, I'm sorry if you said this, but I must have missed it. Was this Verizon talking, or was this Sprint?
This would be Verizon with Alcatel-Lucent as the hardware provider and partner. But Verizon was very good to demonstrate or explain the differences between their carrier deployment, Sprint, and AT&T. AT&T is deploying an LTE solution. They're taking a different approach to their solution, so I'm not sure. The session I went to for AT&T was definitely different from Verizon's approach. Verizon is putting in fiber from their switches, the switch out to the radio mobile base station, whereas AT&T is upgrading the base station, but not all the way back to the switch. They have a different approach. I'm not sure what to make of it. The reason I point this out is even though you may have an LTE cell site with all this robust connectivity between the end user, portable device, and the cell site, the backhaul is imperative that you have bandwidth. And the only way you can get bandwidth, or I won't say unlimited, but lots of bandwidth or expandability, scalability, is with fiber. Verizon is providing fiber back to all their switches. AT&T apparently is not doing that. But that could change. I don't know.
So here we've been discussing this in terms of what can a broadcaster do with this technology. Of course, it's going to be rolled out, I suppose, focused as a consumer technology, perhaps with some perks for people who want to pay more and use it more professionally, especially maybe in terms of upload bandwidth, if you know that's the kind of thing that they want to charge extra for. But let's look at this from the consumer side. Is this kind of technology the beginning of whittling away the need for terrestrial over-the-air transmitters?
You could look at it that way, yes. They did demonstrate the use of a pad type or a tablet type surface, which would do everything you'd expect a computer would do. You can do all your music, your audio. I could see that this would be the start. They are also producing business models or services for broadcasters. The folks that I met with, there are two groups. One of them handles the vertical integration business. And they're talking to broadcasters throughout the country about how to better, I guess not better use, but come up with applications for the LTE. And they demonstrated a few. A company called Livecast kind of has a video product that you can use for web, for TV, video, over the LTE. Very impressive. Again, this was a closed-loop test, so it looked great. Real-world stats, don't know yet. But definitely, if it does work the way they claim it does, it will. TV stations could benefit from this and integrate video on site in a manner that they normally would roll a truck to. You can now do it on spot real fast. So it's a game changer on many levels, and terrestrial transmitters could be something slowly phasing away. In the near term, I don't think so, but you know,
sure.
Eventually.
Sure. I gotta believe so too. I mean, the same thing could happen in the cable TV industry when their cable and satellite dish have such a huge penetration, the number of viewers on TV. You know, a lot of TV stations are running these big honking transmitters. Well, now that analog has been shut off, maybe not as big, but running big transmitters to really only cover a very small percentage of the people who are watching their station, because most of them are getting the station via cable or via dish. And I got to imagine that, okay, here you have a model of radio transmission that's worked for us for decades and decades now. And but eventually when we put these LTE receivers into automobiles, and the automobile entertainment system is based on being able to receive anything that's streaming on the public internet, and they're thereby available over the LTE or WiMAX or whatever it happens to be, it seems to be that the need for terrestrial transmitters will decrease and decrease. We might end up with a situation like the Voice of America or BBC World Service, where they've shut off some, if not all, of their shortwave transmitters. And they're doing a lot more work over streaming or setting up local FM transmitters in some really rural areas and third world countries. But my point is that they've realized that for them, the shortwave transmissions were just a lot of electricity, a lot of money going to pay for electricity, and not getting a whole lot of benefit from that anymore. Chris Tarr, what are your thoughts about that, about the eventuality of people getting all their entertainment from IP packets?
I don't believe it's going to happen. I think it's a good thought. I think that there's a lot of reasons why it might make sense. But, you know, if you're out in the middle of nowhere in Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, it just the connectivity is going to take such a long time to get there, and it's going to cost so much money. It's going to be a long time before you get that same kind of bang for your buck that you get from just radio transmission, from just, you know, AM, FM, that sort of thing. I do think it'll be an option, and you certainly don't want to close your eyes to it. But, go ahead.
It seems kind of similar to the case of, my wife's parents live out in the boonies, in Tennessee, and they can't get high-speed internet out there at all. They have satellite internet, but you wouldn't call that high speed. You certainly can't stream a YouTube video over it. So, yeah, there's a place. It's 10 miles outside of a decent-sized town, but they can't get these higher-speed services. And I don't know if 4G will be covering them, or if it will, when will that be? So, okay, and, you make a point. There's plenty of rural areas that have got to be served by the model we've had, which is tall towers and big transmitters.
And I also need to make the case, too, and I've said this before, and I'll continue to say it. Even with 4G, if you take for example, just use New York City, drive time in the morning, drive time in the afternoon, every vehicle with the 4G data, all of them trying to stream programming at the same time. How long do you think it's going to take before that gets all choked up, and that just becomes nothing but stuttering streams? I think someday it will happen. I don't think it'll happen as soon as people think. It just, the bandwidth has to come from somewhere. The money to build it out has to come from somewhere. The 4G data isn't going to be free. So I just don't see a day anytime in the near future when we're going to see terrestrial broadcasting go away. It's just such a cheap and easy and static free, and static meaning, the ease of use. You can have a little battery-powered radio in your hand and receive the information. And it works, when the power's out, all these different things. So I just think that it's going to be a long time before that goes away.
Well, you're true. That's some very good points. Very good points there. Well, we've kind of run this topic quite a bit. A lot of this, we just have to wait and see how it rolls out, and if it's tiered, if it's capped. I mean, if there's caps or a tiered model, maybe people would be discouraged from listening to the radio over LTE and listening to their favorite radio station, whether it's local or distance. If every time you stream that, you realize you're getting closer and closer to your cap, and you get to the middle of the month and you realize, oh man, I've used enough data here to put me in the next tier. There may be a cost involved there, whereas broadcasting AM, FM over-the-air TV is still free and probably will remain that way. Hey, Chris, you wanted switch topics, yeah. I think. Go ahead. go ahead, Mr. Tarn, wrap this up.
Oh, no, I was going to – I had the next subject we were going to go to.
Okay, sure. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, there's just a for those of you who aren't on the Society of Broadcast Engineers mailing list, there's a great conversation this week about using Visio to design studios, to figure out where things are going to go in racks. And it got me to thinking, there's a lot of software tools out there that engineers use. And I know there's several freebies that I use for doing different things. So I just wanted to get a discussion going about what you guys, some of your favorite software you use almost day to day in the business.
Wow. Well, Visio is one of them, and I don't use it as much as I used to, but both when I worked at radio stations and designed some layouts, and when I worked for Scott Studios, and when I worked for, as I'm working now, for Telos Omnia Axia, we use Visio fairly often. We've made our own custom libraries, for example, at Telos the little shapes of our equipment, so we can then more easily connect things together. I always have a problem with Visio of getting the lines to land exactly where I want them to. And that seems to, man. And I was talking to one of our design engineers. He says, oh, yeah, I got the same problem, but he showed me a bunch of tricks around that. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors and trickery to end up getting the line to be exactly precisely where you want it to be. Visio's good for us.
I
use Visio, Excel sometimes, and actually Microsoft Word. But Visio has been great. The hardest part is just trying to find all the various icons you want to use, the symbols from time to time when you forget where you put them. Other than that, it's a great tool.
One of the things that got brought up on the list in terms of symbols was going to through Google Images and finding images of the equipment that you're going to use and shrinking it down and using that for Visio, which I thought was a great idea. I hadn't even thought of that. Visio is one that I use a lot. There's also, if you look around, there's a lot of neat freebies out there if you know where to look. For example, if you do a search for, I believe it's RF Investigator, you can plot transmission systems, STL systems, to find out, path links and things like that. Cavell Mertz has a great add-in at their site, fccinfo.com, that overlays station data on Google Earth. So you go to Google Earth and you can zoom into a city and see where all the tower sites are. And you click on the different sites and it gives you a pop out of the technical information of the stations. All of that is completely free.
Huh. And that's if you'll shoot me that website, I'll put it on the show notes. But I think I've seen that before at Cavell and Mertz. They're consulting engineers that they provide that.
Yep. And they have a site called FCC Info, which is a great database. It actually is a front end to the FCC database where you can just on their site punch in call letters or, you know, cities and things and find out a great deal of information about radio. But I love the Google Earth plugin because you can just zoom in, you know, anywhere in the state that you're in or in the area of interest and see all the stations pop up, and you can sort it by AM, FM, TV, that sort of thing. And it'll show you where the tower sites are. And then you can do the pop-up, and it shows you all the technical information of the station. So it's really handy if, for example, you're driving somewhere and you see a tower of interest and you go, oh, I wonder what that is. Go back and take a look. Okay. And then also the RF Investigator software, if you do a search for that, I can't recall the company that does it offhand. It's actually a free version of some paid software that they have. I use it all the time for example, Marty shots for things like planning STL hops. You can take the site locations of the transmit and receive sites, do the elevation, and it has the geodata already in the program, and it'll tell you if your path is going to make it, what your signal is going to be like on the other end. Great for planning those remote broadcasts, and absolutely free.
Hmm. Okay. Nice. Chris Tobin, you have some, you were going to add in some software that you like to use.
Oh, there was the Vizio I use, and then I think it's Wirecad. I'm trying to remember now. It's been a while since I've used that one. Wirecad. It works really nice. I haven't had to do any design work recently, but that was really well-tuned for broadcast. You know, Vizio, you sort of have to tailor it, make all your custom templates, and go from there. But the Wirecad was pretty much designed for broadcast and plug-and-play, if you will, for graphics. Really nice stuff. And there was another one that I used about a year ago. I think it was Shareware, and that may not be around anymore. But it has a lot of stuff. You can't go wrong. It's nice, too. You got to document. If you don't document, you just wind up in trouble down the road. And nice, clean documentation never goes bad.
Yeah, there have been plenty of times when I've been to a site where I wish somebody would have thought, you know, would have had that foresight to document like that. You know,
how I would many have times accepted have a napkin.
Yeah, right. Right. I don't know how many times I would have to go back retroactively and document that. Another piece of software, too, as I'm thinking about it, Continental Transmitters has their software that helps you plan out transmitters and HD transmitter planning. It's a handy little tool as well. And you can get that at Continental's Transmitters website.
Haven't there been some softwares that are free that let you easily plan, like transmission line loss and Chris Tarr, you mentioned a program a few minutes ago about planning an STL shot that had to do with line of sight over terrain. But what about all the gains and losses in an STL system? Can you also calculate those? Because there is a free program that lets you do that. It has databases of the transmission line and the different types of antennas and what frequency you're using them at, you know, typically 950 megahertz or so. It even has a database of the receivers that are used typically, so you can you know what the receiver sensitivity is.
I know there's I've seen some DOS programs like that, and I know there's some newer ones, but RF Tools, I believe, was one that did what you're talking about, and that I think was by RF Specialties. I'm trying to think. There was one other one that I was just thinking of along those lines. That works really, really well, too. I'll have to come back to it because it's not left. Now it's left my head. But there's also, if you search around, there's also, and I'll get you links to all this stuff, but there's a site that has, you know, AM and FM databases that you can have on your computer. And, of course, if you have some money, one of the best references you can have on your computer is the NAB Engineering Handbook. They provide that in PDF that you can have on your computer, and I've used that plenty of times, too. Go ahead.
Hey, Chris, question. I had a couple of guys on my staff recently asked these questions, and I verified that it was legitimately normal. PPM encoding, the Arbitron stuff. Do you find, and I'm trying to find who started this crazy crazy rumor, I assume you're a plus 4 dBm 0 VU plant, correct?
Correct, yes.
You take your PPM encoder, You put it into the audio chain. Let's say a typical audio chain is the output of the console, the possibly a profanity delay if your company requires it. If not, then you go to the output of the console. Again, broad strokes. No, you know, I'm not talking DAs and everything else. PPM encoder, maybe a set of audio processing, STL, and then transmitter. Is that safe to say is yes?
Similar. I have mine after the AGCs, because I have outboard AGCs. And now, that's simply because the AGCs drive the line out to the site where I have the...
But no one has ever said to you that the box, the encoders require more than plus 4 or plus 8 to operate? Because I got this vicious rumor running around that you were supposed to be, you know, these boxes work best at plus 22 dB and plus 12, and you've got to put an amplifier in front of it or AGC because it needs to be all these wacky level sets. And I have yet to find a box not function normally at plus 4.
All I've heard, I haven't heard the actual numbers from people, but I have heard that those boxes are very sensitive to the audio level that you give them. Now, whatever that audio level is, I hear different stories, just like you, from anywhere from plus 4 to plus 22 to, you know, whatever. But I do know, and the one common thread I hear is that they're very picky about what they hear. Having said that, I really haven't had any problems with encoding since I put them in. So, I haven't made any significant changes. You know, my audio is still plus 4, and I don't seem to have any issues with encoding. So
that's what I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it really hasn't been an issue. But I do know that they are sensitive, especially to low level. Now, I have had issues where, for example, a jock would have a pot not turned up all the way when they're playing audio, and they're just not running the board very well. And, 3 minutes into the song, I get the alert that it's not encoding anymore because of a low signal. So I have had occasional issues like that, but nothing major that has concerned me.
So what basically I'm getting, I've talked to about a dozen folks today. I've been making calls across the country just to randomly select, pick people's brains. So what it sounds like to me is plus 4, 0 VU is proper. However, if you're not watching what we would call nominal levels within that range, then you expect the box to probably not encode. That's cool. I can get that.
Yeah.
And that's probably
what's going on. And for those of you who are kind of wondering what we're talking about, PPM is the new technology that Arbitron, the radio ratings company, has come out with. And essentially what it is it's this black box that you put in your audio chain before you hit the final audio processing in the transmitter. And it watermarks the audio. And then what happens is people in the public randomly are selected to carry these, almost look like pagers, these devices that decode the watermark in the audio, and that's now how radio ratings are going to happen. It's going to be based on actual listening with these devices that listen for the watermarks in the audio. So as engineers, what we've been doing in these markets where we're launching these this PPM, or personal portable people meter, is installing these boxes and making sure that they work, because if this watermark doesn't happen, if this watermark isn't constantly encoded on your audio, you're not going to get any ratings at all. It used to be where people would write down what they listened to in the day, and so it was based on aided recall. Now it's based on actual listening. And if this watermark doesn't get out over the audio and get received with the people meter, you don't get ratings. So it's very critical that this stuff works correctly. And that's what Chris and I were talking about, is these boxes need to have audio in order to encode, because they use a very thin sliver of audio spectrum to watermark the data, and they bury that in music, which is why the boxes will not encode if there's no audio coming through, because you would hear the encoding process then. So these boxes only encode when you're feeding audio to them. So again, they're very sensitive to the audio level that you give them, and if you don't give them enough audio and they don't encode, you're not getting ratings, and that's obviously a very bad thing.
Yes, very bad. Okay, yeah, thank you. I was about to explain what PPM was about. I realized gone a little too far without explaining the inside baseball there. So, all right, cool. Hey, with the summer coming upon us, have you done your summer treatment to your transmitter sites? Have everything checked out, filters clean, the bee's nest taken out, and air conditioners looked at?
Oh, yeah. We have the final go-through where we have the HVAC guys come out and take a look at all the blowers and the fan belts and everything, and we go through the go through the filters, and with AM sites, we go through and make sure all the weeds are gone and cleaned up. And with the lightning season and everything, make sure the spark gaps are set correctly and the ground straps are in good condition and all those sorts of things. So we have absolutely have done that.
It's been really hot in so many areas. We talked about this on our last show, too, about transmitter sites getting too hot and overheating. Did you have any more advice that you thought of after last week to share with us this week, or just do your best to keep the place cool?
Well, we were just talking about, I don't know if you caught any of the PPM conversation. We actually were talking about PPM encoding a little bit there, but we were talking about getting sites ready for summer. And essentially, it was just kind of the rundown of what I do before the weather gets too bad. And again, that was, you know, making sure, especially with AM tower sites, that there's no weeds inside the fence line, you know, that you have your spark gap set correctly. By the way, Nautel has a great white paper on that. And you'd be surprised how many sites incorrectly gap the spark balls. It's usually way too much gap in there. But, you know, make sure that the spark balls are gapped and the grounding system is in good shape and those sorts of things to get ready for the hot weather. Now, I got an email here for a message here from the Twit guys, spark gaps. What those are, they look like balls that are at the end of the transmitter or the tower. And essentially what they do is they allow lightning. If lightning strikes the tower, it allows the electricity from the lightning to jump to ground, because these towers are floating. AM towers aren't grounded because of, you know, how the RF and that's where you can't ground them because it creates a short to ground. So what you do is you have these two sets of balls at the base of the tower. And when lightning hits, the lightning comes down and it finds the quickest way to get to ground, and that's across these gaps. And what happens times...
One ball is attached to the tower, and the other ball is attached to the ground.
Yeah? Right. And a common problem is that one of the downsides to this is a lot of times transmitters will fault as the lightning makes that connection from ball to ball. So a lot of engineers, when they get a lot of, you know, transmitters bouncing up and down, they tend to knock them out just a little bit more, you know, to keep them on a little bit longer. And what happens is eventually they get worked out way too far. And if the lightning can't go to ground, it goes right into your equipment. So you'd be surprised. A lot of people are surprised how quickly, or how closely rather, that you need to really have these ball gaps set. And there's math you can do to calculate that distance. In fact, for my 5 kilowatt amp station, it's just a couple of millimeters. And in fact, just take a couple of business cards in between those two and get it there. And that's how you protect your system. But I check that, you know, at least once or twice a year to make sure that those are still where they should be, because that's really important.
So Chris Tobin takes care of, or looks after a little bit, some 50 kilowatt AM sites. These pretty high power sites. I got to have a little piece of trivia here for you. In Nashville, at the site of WSM, which is 50,000 watts, they have a tower that is about 5/8 of a wave tall. So it's a pretty tall tower, 700 and some feet. And it's one of the Blaw Knox towers. So it's, you know, guide only in the center of the tower. And above that, it's a diamond-shaped tower and guide at the center. And then the top is all freestanding. Well, it has, you know, spark gap at the base of the tower outside. And the balls for it are just enormous. And they're of course, sitting fairly close to each other. One is grounded. The other is connected to the tower. And this is across the huge base insulator, which is probably 5 or 6 feet tall. It's actually two ceramic insulators back to back. The entire weight of this tower sits on two pieces of ceramic. Well, if you go to WSM's transmitter site during the summer, there will be on the ground side of things what looks like a hairdryer, and it will be blowing air between the lightning balls. Why?
To increase the dielectric properties of the air gap. I'll take that as a stab.
I would have said just to keep the bugs out is what I would have said.
Well, hey, Chris, probably to keep the bugs out, yes.
Yeah, but that's what it is. Apparently, gnats would swarm, and apparently the dielectric constant of a gnat is less than the dielectric constant of air.
You know what? My engineer in Madison, Tony, assistant of mine, had this great idea, and it works wonderfully. I was trying to develop. We had the same problem with bugs getting in there and water getting in there and shorting out. And I was trying to develop this box to go around. I mean, I think I've told this story before. This box to go around to cover the gaps. And you know, I'm sitting there trying to, you know, come up with this Rube Goldberg device. He grabs a 2-liter soda bottle, slits it down the center, pops it over the ball gaps, and tie wraps it down. problem solved. We don't have bugs in there anymore, and no more problems like that. Just for a 99-cent soda bottle, you know, zip tied around the gaps. So it works wonderfully. But that's why I thought of that, because we have the same problem.
Okay, so here's another situation. I went to a station and they were having a problem. Every time it would rain, the transmitter would fault off more frequently. And I've just given it away. So I went out to inspect the bottom of the tower to see if anything was obviously wrong there. And the previous engineer had set the ball gaps up in the following manner. I'll have to show you. One was above the other.
That's no good.
Drip.
Oh, that's no good.
Drip,
that's no good.
Drip. Yeah. And of course, water does have a very low dielectric constant, and the RF would just flow right across there to ground, and the transmitter would go and shut off. So, you know, a little knocking with a hammer. Well, I turned the transmitter off. A little knock with a hammer, a little loosening the bolts and tightening the bolts, and I was able to get them back side by side like this. It seemed to work. Is there the equivalent of a ball gap for an FM antenna?
For an FM antenna, no, because FM antennas are designed with a DC to ground. They're high impedance to RF, but low impedance to DC. And as far as a ball gap approach, you use a product that looks like a toilet bowl brush above to discharge static off the tower. I know their brand names for it. But as far as ball gaps, no.
What you do want to do though is ground the outer of the coax somewhere when you get to the base of the tower. However,
and you're right. There are most FM antenna brands are designed that they're actually a DC short. So if you're at the bottom of the tower and you have the coax that's going to the FM antenna. Doesn't matter if it's small coax or big, or a big antenna or a small one. If it's an FM transmission antenna, chances are it's designed to be shorted at DC. So you put an ohm meter across the inner and the outer conductor of the transmission line, and you'll find a very low resistance, just the resistance of the copper all the way up the tower where the short is and all the way back. Typically, this is done using what's called a quarter wave stub. And this is oftentimes put at the top of the antenna. If there's several bays all stacked up, one wavelength or a half wavelength apart, the very top of the transmission line will actually be a quarter wave stub. And this is a DC short. But let's say you're running 98.1 megahertz into this antenna, and the stub is calculated to be a quarter of a wave at 98.1 megahertz, then it won't bother the 98.1 megahertz at all. It won't even realize that there's a short there because of the nodality of RF as it goes through a transmission line. So there are some FM antennas that don't have a DC short, and some people would say that they're more susceptible to lightning problems. So there's companies who do offer that, tout that as being very important and quite good. A lot of antennas are also shorted just by their design, by the feed characteristics of the bay itself. And so the center does go to the outer, and so each bay is DC shorted. In fact, it was the ERI rototiller design that is not shorted by its nature. It's open, and so the guys at ERI decided that they would offer the quarter wave stuff. They've been offering that for decades now.
Coax, you're in good shape.
Yeah,
the trick is to properly ground the coax, and that's what I'm talking to some antenna design folks. It was FM station I worked at years ago. Put a two rototillers, a two bay, up on top of a 500-foot tower. Decided to only ground it at the top, the base of the antenna after the quarter wave, and then at the base of the tower. So if you could picture 500 feet of 1 5/8 coax, no ground strapped anywhere between it, made for a really nice antenna pickup. We had a nice storm come through, very dry air during the summer, static electricity everywhere, corona discharge from the lightning, and we took a hit, put a hole in the coax about halfway up.
You know, and this is a good thing to explain because if you have a tower, let's imagine a tower that's holding an FM antenna, and the tower itself is grounded in this case, not an AM tower. So the tower goes down to the ground. There's no base insulator at the ground. There are ground rods that take the steel of the tower and put that electrically into the ground. So the tower is grounded. Lightning hits the tower. Most of it pretty much goes to ground, goes to the earth. Well, you have a transmission line now that's attached to the tower. The transmission line is insulated. It's got, you know, a plastic on the outside of it. And the transmission line is held to the tower typically by something called a butterfly clamp that just clamps the outer of the coax, the plastic part, at intervals all the way up the tower. And so you may say, well, hey, the coax is the outer part of it, the ground part of the coax. Well, it's bonded to the tower. It's grounded at the top anyway. Why do I need to ground it anywhere else? And so if you think about what happens when lightning strikes, lightning hits the tower, and this enormous current is it goes through the tower itself. Well, what is a transformer? A transformer is, you know, windings that are next to each other. And so a magnetic field set up in one winding, and the tower becomes, you know, a partial winding to the electricity, induces a voltage in the other winding that's near it, the other winding being the coax that's near it. So what you have is an enormous pulse of energy that's produced into the ungrounded coax by induction. You have an induction of enormous proportions can go into the coax that's not grounded. So if you ground the coax, typically they'll do it at intervals, or certainly at the top of the tower, the middle of the tower, and the bottom of the tower, and upon entrance into the transmitter building itself. So you give the lots of opportunities for anything that has built up, because remember, DC, lightning isn't DC, it's an alternating current. And it will thereby induce itself into things that are nearby, especially things that are nearby and parallel. Did I explain that right?
Yes. No, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. It's makes for an interesting spark show. And the debris, the holes in the cable, it was fun. Halfway up the tower, it's almost sliced in half.
We're about out of time, but let's chat about one more thing. Mr. Tarr may have seen this, and I think I've seen this once. What is St. Elmo's fire on an FM antenna?
Ooh, that's a good one. I haven't actually seen that before.
Oh, okay.
I've seen it on AM towers all the time.
Oh, okay. Well, what's it look like on AM towers?
A big blue ball.
A big blue ball? Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sure. You're talking about where the static charges up on the metal, correct?
Yeah, especially when thunderstorms are nearby and there gets to be and the atmosphere conditions are right that there's a lot of static buildup on the tower.
Yeah.
One time I got a phone call from somebody way out in the boonies near a very tall tower that I took care of the transmitter there. And they said, hey, your antenna up there in that tower, it's on fire. It's got blue flames coming out of it.
Yeah, I've seen it where it's gone up and down between the tower and the guy wires. It happens quite a lot out here in the winter when it gets real dry and the winds pick up and the guy wires whip around. It tends to create static electricity, and you'll see the balls of sparks run up and down. You have to turn the transmitter off and back on. So
yeah, I've had that happen during winter time. Yeah. Dry air.
Yeah. Doesn't a static drain choke at the bottom of the AM tower eliminate that problem, or does it build up faster than a static drain choke and wick the
usually builds up faster than it can get drained, and generally what will happen is it'll run up and down the tower a couple times and then they'll finally just on its own dissipate enough where it gets drained.
So I checked the transmitter readings when they said, hey, your tower's on fire, and the transmitter was fine, and there was no extra reflected power. I ended up getting in the car and making a late-night drive to the transmitter site, and by the time I got out there, the event was over, and there was no fire coming out of the antenna. But I'm sorry I missed it. I'm sure there are engineers who have seen that. Guys, we've had a kind of a casual show here, but we're going to have to wrap it up. Next week is going to be a War Stories show. Yes, it is a Divide by 10 episode. It'll be episode number 40 next week. So prep your war stories. We're going to see if we can have an engineer on here in addition to us to bring us a few war stories, him or herself. So we'll look forward to that next week. Mr. Tobin, anything else from you in Manhattan tonight?
No. I'm just going to get myself something to eat, enjoy a little adult beverage, and then make my way to the Empire State Building from some overnight work. That's about it.
All right. Thanks for the report on LTE and how that might be helping broadcasters. Mr. Tarr, anything from you, sir, to wrap it up?
No, I'd just like to say hi to everybody from Wisconsin. I see we have a couple of cheeseheads in the chat room, so hello to them.
Yeah, we got people in the chat room from absolutely everywhere. Well, thanks a lot, guys. I'm Kirk Harnack, and I appreciate you joining us. You can download This Week in Radio Tech, the podcast, from our website, thisweekinradiotech.com. You can also conveniently subscribe to the podcast in the iTunes store. Just do a search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T. You'll see a couple of them there. Ours is pretty obvious which one it is. Click the subscribe button. It's free, and it'll download to your computer every time an episode is posted. There's also an RSS feed button available on the website, so we sure appreciate that. We appreciate you saying something nice or supporting the people who make our show possible, the sponsors who are mentioned at the beginning of the show. We appreciate that. Hey, thanks to the Burke at the TWIT Network and the TWIT facilities. We appreciate you, too. Thanks for listening to This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another TWIRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.